Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, Unlocking the Brain's Secrets. We're diving into the fascinating world of circadian rhythms.
Our internal clocks, right? The roughly 24-hour cycles that govern so much of our biology.
Exactly. And it's not just humans. These rhythms are found in a vast array of life, from plants and fungi to even bacteria.
It's incredible to think about these tiny cyanobacteria with their own internal clocks ticking away.
It really is. And the fascinating thing is, evidence suggests these rhythms evolved independently in each kingdom of life.
So not a single ancestral clock, but multiple parallel developments? That's remarkable.
Precisely. It speaks to the fundamental importance of these rhythms for survival. Now, the term circadian, as you probably know, comes from the Latin circa, meaning around, and dies, meaning day.
Around a day, about 24 hours. But there's a distinction between circadian and diurnal rhythms, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Diurnal simply refers to a 24-hour cycle. Circadian rhythms, however, must be endogenous, originating within the organism, not just a response to environmental changes.
So, driven by an internal clock, not simply reacting to the external world, but our internal clocks are still influenced by the environment, right? Like light and temperature?
Absolutely. These external cues are called Zeitgebers, and they help synchronize our internal clocks to the external world. Light is a particularly powerful Zeitgeber.
And when these rhythms go awry, that's when we see circadian rhythm sleep disorders.
Precisely. Now, the history of our understanding of these rhythms is quite interesting. The earliest recorded observation goes all the way back to the 4th century BC with Theophrastus.
He described a tree, later identified as the tamarind tree, whose leaves opened and closed with the sun, almost like it was sleeping.
Yeah. And there are mentions of circadian processes in humans in 13th century Chinese medical texts. But the first real experiment to distinguish an internal clock from environmental responses was by Jean-Jacques Dortu de Meuron in 1729.
He observed the leaf movements of the Mimosa pudica plant, even in constant darkness, showing that the rhythm was internal, not just a reaction to light.
Exactly. And then fast forward to 20th century, we have researchers like Szymanski demonstrating similar endogenous rhythms in animals.
And then, of course, the groundbreaking work with fruit flies by Kalmus and Bunning in 1935, which really solidified the existence of these internal clocks.
Yes. And Pittenry's experiment with Drosophila in 1954, which showed that temperature could influence the timing, but not stop the rhythm altogether. That was crucial.
It's like the clock keeps ticking, even if it's running a little slow or fast. And then Halberg coined the term circadian in 59.
Right. And the definition has been refined over the years, leading to the one formally adopted by the International Society for Chronobiology in 1977.
Which clarifies that circadian rhythms are about 24 hours, but not always exactly 24 hours. And they can be synchronized with or desynchronized from the local environment.
Yes. Now, the real breakthroughs in understanding the molecular mechanisms came with the discovery of clock genes, starting with the period gene in Drosophila.
Identified by Kanapka and Benzer in 71, and then isolated in 84, leading to the Nobel Prize for Hall, Rosbash, and Young in 2017, their work really illuminated the genetic underpinnings of these rhythms.
Absolutely. And Takahashi's discovery of the first mammalian clock mutation in mice in 94 was another huge step, although the role of the clock gene itself has become a bit more nuanced in recent years.
Right. Some studies question its importance in rhythm generation, but the identification of the first human clock mutation by Jones, Fu, and Tachek was a landmark discovery. It linked a specific genetic change to familial advanced sleep phase syndrome.
Yes, those individuals are extreme morning larks. And these discoveries really underscore the conserved nature of the molecular clock across species. So to be considered circadian, a biological rhythm has to meet three criteria. It has to persist in constant conditions, be entrainable by Zeitgebers, and maintain a relatively constant period across a range of physiological temperatures.
So it has to be internally driven, responsive to the environment, but also stable in the face of temperature fluctuations. That makes sense.
Now, one of the key benefits of circadian rhythms is that they allow organisms to anticipate environmental changes. This gives them a significant advantage in terms of resource utilization.
They're prepared for the dawn, the dusk, the changing seasons. They can optimize their activities for when resources are available or when predators are less active.
Exactly. But it's not just about the external environment. These rhythms are also crucial for coordinating internal processes, metabolic processes, hormonal fluctuations, cell regeneration. It's all orchestrated by the circadian clock.
It's like the body's internal conductor, keeping everything in sync and running smoothly.
A great analogy. And the question of how these rhythms evolved is still being explored. Initially, it was thought they might have evolved to protect DNA replication from UV radiation. But that theory doesn't quite hold up, especially considering cyanobacteria.
Right. They actually divide more in the daytime. The current thinking points to the great oxidation event and the need to manage reactive oxygen species generated by daylight.
Precisely. The circadian clock would have evolved to anticipate and counteract these damaging redox reactions. And speaking of cyanobacteria, their circadian clocks are remarkably simple. Just three proteins can reconstitute a 22-hour rhythm in vitro.
Amazing. And the fact that a defect in the human homologue of the Drosophila period gene causes FASPS reinforces the evolutionary conservation of these mechanisms.
Yes. The basic machinery is surprisingly similar across such diverse life forms. Now, this molecular clock operates within individual cells, but those cells also communicate with each other to synchronize their rhythms.
So each cell has its own clock, but they all need to be on the same page. And the master clock in mammals is the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SCN, in the hypothalamus.
Exactly. Damage to the SCN completely abolishes the regular sleep-wake cycle. It receives light information from the eyes, specifically from specialized ganglion cells that are directly photosensitive.
So even without conscious vision, the SCN gets the light signal it needs to keep the clock synchronized with the external world. And it uses that information to regulate melatonin production in the pineal gland.
Right. Melatonin levels peak at night, providing information about night length. Although the feedback loop between melatonin and the SCN is still not fully understood.
It's like a two-way street, but we're still mapping out the traffic flow. Now, human circadian rhythms aren't perfectly aligned with the 24-hour day, are they?
No, they're not. Studies have shown we can be entrained to slightly shorter or longer cycles. And there's even some evidence of sex differences in circadian periods.
Women with slightly shorter cycles tending to wake up earlier? Interesting. And how do we measure these rhythms? Body temperature, melatonin levels?
Those are the classic markers. Body temperature typically reaches its minimum a couple of hours before waking. Melatonin onset and offset are also used, with the offset potentially being a more reliable marker.
And beyond temperature and melatonin, there's heart rate, hormone production, cellular processes, a whole cascade of events orchestrated by the circadian clock.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that while the SCN is the master clock, there are also peripheral clocks in other organs and cells throughout the body.
Each cell with its own rhythm, but synchronized by the SCN. It's a complex and beautifully orchestrated system. And what about when this system is disrupted? Jet lag, shift work?
These disruptions can have significant health consequences, particularly for cardiovascular health. And even artificial light at night can interfere with melatonin production and disrupt our rhythms.
Which highlights the importance of aligning our lifestyles with our natural circadian rhythms as much as possible. Getting enough sleep, regular exercise, minimizing light exposure at night, these are all crucial for maintaining our internal clocks.
So we're talking about the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SCN, this tiny but mighty region of the brain that orchestrates our circadian rhythms.
It's remarkable, isn't it? This little cluster of neurons right above the optic chiasm, essentially conducting the symphony of our daily biological cycles. Everything from sleep-wake cycles to hormone release, body temperature fluctuations.
It's all influenced by the SCN. And what's fascinating is how it receives light input directly from the retina through those specialized photosensitive ganglion cells. So even if you can't consciously see, the SCN still sees the light and dark cycles, keeping your internal clock synchronized with the external world.
Right, that's the retinohypothalamic tract. It's like a direct line from the eyes to the SCN, telling it what time it is. And it's not just light, is it? There are other inputs too, like from the intergeniculate leaflet and the Raphe nuclei, which modulate the SCN's response.
Exactly. It's a complex interplay of signals. And within the SCN itself, you have different cell types, like the VIP and AVP neurons, each playing a distinct role. The VIP neurons seem particularly crucial for light entrainment, while the AVP neurons are more involved in setting the actual period of the circadian rhythm.
So, like a clock with different gears, each contributing to the overall mechanism? And the SCN's influence extends far beyond itself, doesn't it? It projects to areas all over the brain, including the hypothalamus, thalamus, and lateral septum, coordinating rhythms throughout the body.
Absolutely. It's like a master conductor, sending signals to different sections of the orchestra to ensure everyone plays in time. And damage to the SCN can have profound effects, disrupting sleep patterns, hormone levels, and even mood.
That's right. We see this in conditions like irregular sleep-wake rhythm disorder and even major depressive disorder, where circadian rhythms are often disrupted. And the molecular clockwork within the SCN itself is incredibly intricate, with those feedback loops involving genes like CLOCK, BMAL1, PER, and CRY.
It's a complex dance of gene expression driving the 24-hour cycle. And the fact that these genes are conserved across so many species, from fruit flies to humans, really underscores the fundamental importance of circadian rhythms for life.
It's a testament to the power of evolution, finding similar solutions across diverse life forms. And the research into these mechanisms has really taken off in recent decades, with scientists like Hartar making significant contributions to our understanding of IPRGCs and their role in non-image-forming vision.
So we've been talking about the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SCN, this master clock in our brains, and how it orchestrates our circadian rhythms. But it's not just a one-way street, is it? There's this fascinating interplay between the SCN and other areas of the brain, particularly the olfactory system.
Right. The olfactory bulb, the primary center for processing smells, actually seems to have its own independent circadian rhythm. It's like a secondary clock ticking away in the nose.
It is. Studies have shown that even without the SCN, the olfactory bulb maintains a circadian rhythm in gene expression and neuronal activity. Although it's important to note that the SCN still plays a crucial role in keeping that rhythm synchronized with the rest of the body.
Yeah, without the SCN, those rhythms in the olfactory bulb become desynchronized, almost like each instrument in an orchestra playing at its own tempo. But what's really interesting is the evidence suggesting a two-way street, so to speak, between the olfactory system and the SCN.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, some studies have shown that olfactory stimuli can actually enhance light-induced activity in the SCN, and conversely, the SCN seems to influence the daily rhythms of olfactory function, like odor detection and discrimination.
So our sense of smell might be influencing our internal clock, and our internal clock might be influencing our sense of smell. It's a complex feedback loop, and we're only beginning to understand the intricacies.
Exactly, and it gets even more complicated when you consider the different cell types within the SCN itself. You have VIP neurons, AVP neurons, CC, K neurons, each with distinct roles in regulating the circadian rhythm.
It's like a finely tuned orchestra, each section playing a specific part, and the SCN is the conductor, making sure everything works in harmony. And damage to the SCN, like lesions, can disrupt this intricate system, leading to problems with sleep, hormone levels, and even mood.
Absolutely. And it's not just light that influences the SCN. There are other factors at play too, like food availability, the presence of predators, even temperature. These can all affect the SCN and, in turn, our circadian rhythms.
It really highlights the interconnectedness of everything, how our internal world is constantly responding to the external world and vice versa. And the olfactory system being so important for survival, for finding food, mates, avoiding danger, it makes sense that it would be closely linked to our circadian rhythms.
It does. And the fact that the olfactory bulb can generate its own rhythm independent of the SCN raises some fascinating questions about how these systems evolved and how they interact. There's still so much we don't know, but the research is really starting to shed light on these complex mechanisms.
So we're delving into this study on the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SCN, and its connection to insomnia in adolescents with major depressive disorder, or MDD. It's a fascinating area, really.
It is, yeah. Especially given how prevalent both depression and sleep problems are in teenagers, this study really tries to tease apart the relationship between the two, focusing on that master clock in the brain, the SCN.
Right. And they use some pretty rigorous methodology using the structured clinical interview for DSM-5, the Hamilton scales for depression and anxiety, and the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. plus fMRI to look at brain connectivity.
Yeah, a good combination of clinical assessments and neuroimaging. And they specifically looked at the connection between the SCN and the procuneus, a region involved in a lot of high-level cognitive functions.
And what did they find? Anything particularly striking?
Well, they split the MDD group into those with high insomnia, MDDHI, and low insomnia, MDDLI. They found that the MDDHI group had decreased connectivity between the right SCM and the bilateral procuneus compared to both the MDDLI group and the healthy controls.
Oh, so a weaker connection between the master clock and this key cognitive hub in the kids with more insomnia. Interesting.
Yeah, and that weaker connection was actually correlated with the severity of insomnia symptoms. The worse the insomnia, the weaker the connection, which suggests that this sulfur monocyanide procuneus link might be playing a role in the sleep problems these kids are experiencing.
I see. So not just that they have depression and insomnia, but the degree of insomnia is linked to this specific brain connectivity pattern.
Exactly. It adds another layer to our understanding of how sleep and depression might be intertwined at a neurological level, particularly in adolescence.
Now, they also controlled for a lot of potential confounding factors, right? Age, sex, head motion during the fMRI.
Yeah, they did, and even adjusted the HAMD scores to remove the influence of sleep so they could look at the relationship between the sulfur monocyanide procuneus connectivity and insomnia independently of overall depression severity.
That's good. Makes the findings more robust. But of course, like any study, this one has its limitations. It's cross-sectional, so we can't infer causality.
Right. We don't know if the disrupted connectivity causes the insomnia or if the insomnia somehow leads to the disrupted connectivity or if there's some other factor influencing both. Longitudinal studies would be needed to really tease that apart.
Definitely. And they relied on self-reported sleep measures, which, while valuable, aren't as objective as something like polysomnography.
True, but overall, it's a valuable contribution to the field, providing more evidence for the complex interplay between sleep, mood, and brain function in adolescents with depression. It opens up new avenues for research into potential treatments targeting these specific brain circuits.
It does. A fascinating glimpse into the brain's inner workings. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Chemistry of the Mind. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in again next time for more explorations into the fascinating world of the brain. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.